Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today we have very special guest, Mr. Keith Amon. He's author of the Monsters Know What They're Doing series, huge D&D monster authority. We're going to dive into his new book, Making Enemies, see how to design great new monsters in D&D or any role-playing game. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I'll remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and it's available to all our patrons. So you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier level, you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that account all set up and ready to go, and about 10 or 15 minutes after the end of the show, Dan and I will be there to chat with you all live.
Really look forward to that. Thanks to all of our patrons there and Backwards for checking in that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream, and thanks for checking on that. And Keith, thank you so much for making time today. Thank you for writing this book that just recently came out, Making Enemies. You can see that I've got labels in a number of the pages because I've really personally gotten sucked into this. It's a little different from the other books that you've written. Maybe tell us how this is different from
yes.
the other stuff you've done.
Well, it's probably most similar to How to Defend Your Lair of all the books I've written, because this is not a granular look at how to run combat encounters specifically in D&D 5e. This is a system ecumenical toolbox for designing original homebrew monsters for either home campaigns or published material or whatever you happen to be wanting to use it for. I've branched out from D&D 5e into other game systems, specifically Pathfinder, Cypher, Shadow Dark, Call of Cthulhu, and it's just an exploration of all sorts of different ideas that I've had about what goes into designing a monster and how you might implement that mechanically and what you can do with an idea that just kind of pops into your head out of nowhere. I mean, one of the things that I have gone out of my way to do in this book is try to make it a better teaching tool in the sense that I really want to start with the germ of the idea and then show readers how I went through the entire process of getting from there to the finished stat block.
That's nice. Fantastic, Keith. As viewers of the show probably know, I adore custom-made monsters. You've probably seen us do it many times on our Dungeon Design Dash. We often will start with Matt Finch's random tables to generate some crazy description of a custom monster and then go down the road of trying to invent that. I'm curious, you mentioned a bunch of other systems. Do you, Dan's gotten a closer look at this book than I have, but do you dig through the mechanics of each individual system? Or if I'm a fan of a system you didn't list there, is this book still going to be useful to me?
So in answer to your first question, superficially, yes. I have an appendix in which I just go through all the different elements of the stat block in each system and talk about what they mean for your monster. You know, what does it mean that your monster has a speed of X? What does it mean that your monster is this level or is able to impose these particular kinds of conditions? Just so you're not fumbling around in the dark. But most of the book talks instead about different aspects of the monster that you include, such as magic use, native habitat, tactical stunts, weaknesses, quirks, vulnerabilities, which I guess are weaknesses, ways of taking a monster and customizing it for your own particular party at that particular moment, working in metaphorical content and biology from world predators that are not necessarily furry or scaly or winged. There's a lot of real world biology that monster designers just don't make use of, and making use of that is fun. A lot of fun.
Awesome.
I feel so. You have a big. I think you have a big first chapter. I think like a really good portion of the book is this first chapter that goes through different mechanically elements that go into monsters, such as what are its politics? Is it a predator? Is it just really big? Is it nature gone wrong? What's its terrain type? And so I think that there's a lot of stuff there you could use to inspire any system. And then you kind of go off in a lot of interesting other directions in the other chapters.
Well, the first chapter is the one that contains the very basic, if you don't do any of the other things in the book, at least do these things chapter. And then, like you said, I branch off in various other directions from there. But chapter one has to do with what level or CR do you make it? Are you going to have just one big one of these things appear, or a lot of little ones, or just a few little ones, or lots of big ones, you know, because all four of those are telling different kinds of stories. They're setting up different kinds of encounters. Natural habitat. What does it mean that a character is native to the desert, or that it's native to forests or swamps? How is that going to shape it in terms of how it moves, how it hunts? What creature type do you want it to be? Which I see as being very closely tied to what kind of story you're trying to tell with it. And those few basic elements are things you want to think about with every monster, even if you're not working in stunts, even if you're not working in magical powers or giving it unique weaknesses or anything like that. You still want to start with those things.
That makes a lot of sense. I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, before we go on, let me ask this. So you've got... again, the ones that you actually detail stats, so D&D 5th Edition, Pathfinder, Shadow Dark, Call of Cthulhu, and the other one, whatever.
Cypher.
There you go. So I thought it was interesting that you include Shadow Dark, and I can't say as I've had my hands on Kelsey Dione's Shadow Dark system. It came out 2 years ago. Praise from all corners. And I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like that's the one that most resembles original D&D that we talk about a lot on this show. Minimalist is what it looks like to my eye. Did you find that when you're thinking about Shadow Dark or something that looks a lot like original D&D, did that minimalism, was that freeing? Was it an obstacle? Did it feel like a constraint that you don't have a lot of these predefined tools like you have in 5th edition?
It just requires a different approach. I would describe Shadow Dark. I would describe it as new school rules with an old school sensibility. Because it really is essentially a very stripped down kind of 5e. But there are some other old school games that are like that too. Knave, for instance. The point, though, is that it's focused on A, being extremely streamlined so that you don't have a whole lot of text to read, and when you are actually playing out the encounter, things are moving along very quickly. But also, the sensibility is very much that you are going into dangerous places and retrieving valuable things. And so The monsters then are hindrances to your accomplishing that. And you want to keep it pretty pared down and only include the things that are going to be relevant to that. And also, when you're being that minimalist, you want every element to be memorable. You don't want any part of that little stat block to be throwaway. You want to pare away everything that's non-essential and just include what's going to increase the salience of the combat encounter with this particular creature. So that is, I wouldn't call that an obstacle or a burden or anything like that. I would call it a constraint. But my personal point of view is that constraints are fun, that bounded creativity is more interesting. It produces more interesting results than unbounded creativity. So having those kinds of limits forces you to refine and to think about what is going to make this monster better and what is just going to make it more. Let's get rid of the more and focus on the better.
Nice. Nice. There is a philosophy among improv teachers, I think, of you can't just keep going crazy thing, crazy thing, crazy thing, crazy thing. And I think they refer to that as going to crazy town. There comes a point where I can't even grab on. Like, what's the point of what we're doing? What am I supposed to pay attention to at this point? I can't follow it anymore. That you need to be to have some tasteful editing in what is the important thing that you're trying to focus on. So that makes a lot of sense to me. I feel
if you think about the seven habits of highly effective people, right? Begin with the end in mind. So imagine the encounter. Imagine what you want the encounter to look like. What is the monster doing in this encounter? Okay, now how do I construct the stat block to produce that? How do I construct the stat block in such a way that the monster is able to do the things that you are visualizing it doing? And in Shadow Dark, that's particularly important.
Right, right. Do you have a thought, Paul?
I was just going to share that Dan and I are absolutely on the same page with the idea of constraints, right? And that's, I think that's often why we usually start with randomization tables to just give us some nuggets of ideas that force us down a specific channel, right? Starting from just a blank page, I think is often just, it's just overwhelming, right? Whereas if we know that we have ice bees, that's a crazy thing. And now my brain is trying to figure out how the hell do ice bees exist and what does that mean? And is there queen-like, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're off to the races.
Mm-hmm. I like the fact that Keith, you put in it didn't need to be there, but at the end of every chapter, every section, you've got a random table for all the elements that we just talked about, maybe all the terrain types or all the features or the challenge rating, maybe. Here's a little table. Help me make up my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? I really appreciated that. If you're stuck, get started here. Work your way back. I really...
I actually did that myself. I set myself a target of I'm going to include 20 monsters in this book. And, you know, about 8 or 9 of them came to me naturally. That's 11 or 12 to go. So I didn't literally roll some dice. I generated some random numbers in Excel, but effectively the same thing. And said, all right, what should I do now? How about a forest plant creature? Okay, well, then I started thinking about what kind of tactics that one would use and ended up using that monster as the capstone illustration for the stunt chapter, the wart camp. There are quite a few in there where I'm just like, okay, I need an idea. Random. Oh, okay, I can use that one. I can do something with that. And went with it. And I think the results bore fruit.
Literally. Now, on the other hand, I was really tickled by the inspiration for the ravenous cult plant thing. Maybe tell
Quarox.
Us.
Quarox. Yeah. Yes. So Quarox is an aberration that, I kid you not, is inspired by a storefront in a neighborhood near the one I live in that my spouse and I drove past several times. And it was called the Ravenous Life Healing Center. And the first time we saw that, we looked at each other and said, that is a front for some kind of vampire cult. And that was a few months before I started writing this, but then after I began writing, I drove past it myself another time and was reminded that it was there and somehow still open. And I said, I'm making a monster out of that. I'm gonna figure out what lives in the basement of that place, and I'm gonna create it. And that's where Quarox came from. I ended up using Quarox as an illustrative example for phased monsters.
Yes.
Now, Quarox is a little bit different from your typical phased monster, which in D&D terms, if you have Mythic Odysseys of Theros, this would be a mythic monster. One that you beat down to zero hit points, and then it changes form and starts wailing on you again in a different way. Like your basic Dark Souls monster, right? Or Shadow. There are a couple of third-party Shadow Dark adventures that have phased monsters that work like this. And with Quarox, what I did instead, it doesn't transform when you knock it down to zero hit points. It transforms when it achieves its goal of draining a certain amount of life. So if it succeeds in draining a certain amount of life, then it moves into its second form, which is more destructive, but also easier to hit. Because my point of view of a phased encounter in a tabletop role-playing game as opposed to a video game is that everything should feel more dangerous in the second phase, or the third phase if you go that far. But you usually don't want to, because these combat encounters can run long. But the second phase should feel more dangerous, but it shouldn't make defeating the monster harder. If anything, it should subtly make it easier. It's dishing out more damage, but you are also able, as the PCs, to dish out more damage to it. So oftentimes, for example, the armor class might be lower. Even though it's you know, putting out more damage, it's also now got a weakness that you can take advantage of in order to knock it down so that you're not just stomped. Now, Call of Cthulhu doesn't work that way. In Call of Cthulhu, the second form is totally more powerful than the first, sometimes dramatically so, but that's Call of Cthulhu, which is an animal of its own.
I thought that was that kind of short chapter on this phased monster idea, which we don't see a lot in classic D&D, was really unique. And I thought that I'm so glad you just mentioned that observation about when the monster comes back. I thought it was a really standout observation that, frankly, I probably would have overlooked, but I'm going to try to keep it in my back pocket, that when it comes back, particularly for pacing purposes, make it do more damage, but also possibly be easier to hit. And I shouldn't be surprised.
Because you just want everything to feel wilder in the second phase.
Yeah.
You want that feeling of things being out of control.
Right. And so here we are on Halloween weekend, which is super appropriate. So just last Sunday, Paul and I had an episode about classic mummies in D&D. And one of our observations were, classically, it's maybe the slowest fight. It's the slowest fight you can possibly have in traditional D&D. They're slow to move. They have slow damage output. They have slow damage intake. And they have a special attack that only plays out months after the fight. And our conclusion was, it's so, and Paul and I are really cognizant about the pacing of the play at our tables. And so our final conclusion is, it's so dragged out. It's so slow. Maybe just replace mummies with a different, it's just, don't, you know, surprise yourself with a random mummy fight that's going to drag out and be boring for everybody. Maybe just skip the mummies altogether. So your observation about, as things get worse, get more dramatic in an ongoing fight, having the pacing go faster rather than slower is so on brand for the kind of thing we like to see. And I think that was like among the most stellar observations that I would have tripped up over if you hadn't said it.
So phased monsters are usually bosses. If not big bosses, at least, you know, intermediate bosses. But suppose you were to take the mummy and make it a low-level phased monster. So what you might do is you might give the mummy about, let's say, 2/3 the hit points you would normally give it. And so that you would expect it only to survive for about 2 rounds. But then, at the end of the second round, when you knock it down to 0 hit points, maybe all the bandages fall off and it turns into a swarm of bugs or something. And then you got to spend a couple of rounds fighting the bugs that used to be the mummy. And it's easy to stomp on a bug, you know, but there's so many of them. So you get that out of control feeling.
It's brilliant. Deviously brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, swarm by scarabs sounds just really fun. I super want to.
So that's how you can. Yeah, that's how you can use some of the tools in this toolbox. And this book really is a toolbox rather than a checklist. But it's how you can take one of these tools and just say, "How can I use this in a creative way?" On a mummy, you know, you can take even something as pedestrian as a mummy, and just with this one little tool, turn it into something a whole lot more memorable.
Brilliant. Brilliant. There's a good fix. I like that fix a lot. Among the things we were talking about.
Viewers, yeah, Paul, watch the scarabs. Live. Like a swarm of scarabs would be fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
it's even on brand, right? It's even in theme.
Yeah.
Love it. So there is, when I open this book up, you have, to me, a bombshell quote in the foreword that really hit me personally in the right place. And so it's by a gentleman named Stephen T. Asma. I've never heard of this writer before. Apparently this is excerpted from Monsters and the Moral Imagination. And so the foreword quote that you have, I'm reading a couple sentences out of it, says, "The liberal interpretation of monsters is to suggest that when we properly embrace difference, the monsters will vanish." I disagree. The monster concept is still extremely useful, and it's a permanent player in the moral imagination because human vulnerability is permanent. As long as there are real enemies in the world, there will be useful dramatic versions of them in our heads. And boy, I thought that was an interesting flag to plant on that debate for this book on monsters in D&D. Where did you find Asma's writings? Because I'd never heard of him before.
Well, for chapter 3, which is Monsters as Metaphors, I delved into the academic discipline of monster theory, which is an actual thing. It's a field of cultural studies. And a lot of it involves thinking about it's some of that very, very, you know, abstract academic stuff that's hard to put into words if you are not using those words all the time with other people who know them. But it also, of more interest to me, involves looking at how monsters throughout history, throughout myth and literature, have been used to represent fears of a particular people at a particular time in a particular place. So, for example, you see Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein at a time when you've got two very big and somewhat related things happening, the Industrial Revolution and the Counter-Enlightenment, which was a kind of romantic movement that emerged in reaction to the Enlightenment, which was basically saying, you can't break everything down into science and reason and declare that that dictates how the entire universe moves. You have to have reverence for the spiritual world, for the natural world. You have to acknowledge that feelings have power. And in some ways, it was also kind of an anti-intellectual movement, and did some harm in that way. But with Frankenstein, you have two monsters. You know, the old joke is that wisdom is, or intelligence is knowing that Frankenstein is not the monster, and wisdom is knowing that Frankenstein is the monster. So you have two monsters in that book. You have the creature, and you have Frankenstein himself. And the creature is your kind of old school monster as barbaric other. But then you also have Frankenstein, who is a monster as this soulless, bloodless individual who abuses the mysteries of life and death and is so cold-blooded that he will let a servant hang for a crime for which he is indirectly responsible. A crime, in fact, against a member of his own family. So, you know, if Frankenstein is a monster because he is this intelligent, educated person who shows none of the moral development that you would expect to go hand in hand with that kind of education. And so that is something that the romantics of that era were very concerned about. They were worried that if we give everything over to science and reason, what's going to be left to make people feel the fear that prevents them from doing abominable things? So that is why a book like Frankenstein can emerge in a time and place like that and have such instant salience. I wandered way off track there, but I was talking about monster theory and how monster theory covers questions like this.
Yeah, so I feel like this chapter on monsters as metaphor for me is the beating heart of this book, frankly. And as we're recording this, there's currently a Frankenstein movie in cinemas right now. So Guillermo del Toro's version of Frankenstein is playing right now. And there's discourse and there's debate around that particular movie. My partner Isabel saw it the other day in the theater, had strong thoughts. We have had a debate here in the household in the last 48 hours about the status of Frankenstein. Paul's starting to laugh here. So I have my copy of Frankenstein is sitting on my shelf right there, and we've had to go reread it this weekend specifically in order to hash out our thoughts about Frankenstein. I think we both still feel that no one's really totally made a book accurate version movie of it. So it's very much on our minds. And I have also been trying to get into the difference of I think that Mary Shelley's perspective of the world at the time is not the same as my perspective of the world now. So I'm trying to think about what she's saying with these developments with this plot versus how I personally would interpret this plot And just like you're saying, Keith, those fears are time and place specific. And it, so these observations from monster theory, I think are, I'm so glad you have them in the book there.
Thank you. Well, and they recur. I mean, that soulless Olympian scientist archetype reappears in the late 90s and early 2000s when you have a, you know, when you have a combination of a lot of technological and biological threats moving into people's consciousness, combined with a large spiritual anti-intellectual movement in society that distrusts science and distrusts scientists and sees them as not having enough respect for just how awesomely central humans are to the entire universe of existence. How dare you say that we are not the most important things in the entire cosmos? And so that archetype appears again in a lot of pop culture.
It's funny. I mean, the joke now of I don't know, tech CEO says we have finally built the machine from the famous book.
The Torment
please,
Nexus.
For the love of God, nobody build this horrible machine or whatever. And I think you've got a line of you know, monsters are. It's not surprising that monsters are everywhere nowadays because everything's scary nowadays. Yeah. And boy, does that hit. You build a whole bunch of monsters. You have a particular elite, mercurial, nobleman, I guess I'm going to say, who, has a lot of, there you go. That seems very on point. Seems probably more on point now than when you wrote it. I guess I'll just leave it at that.
You know, Prince Nimblestep is actually not one that I intended to be particularly metaphorical. Prince Nimblestep is just, he is what he is. He's just a very skilled fey swordsman with an over-the-top temper and just some cool abilities that I repurposed from something else that I had been working on. Now, if you want a couple of explicitly metaphorical monsters from the book, we have the one that ends chapter 3, which is the Nidor, which is a metaphor for enshittification. And
you don't use that word in the book.
Yes, that's what that's all about. And the Thrutcher. And again, I'm kind of coy about this in the book, but I won't bother to be coy here. The Thrutcher is toxic masculinity as a monster. That one is intended to be very metaphorical. And some of the ways in which it operates, well, first of all, there's the fantastic illustration by my spouse, Jen C. Marshall, where you have this, you know, roided out zombie looking guy. But you have the compulsive nature of it, which is why I chose to make that particular creature an undead. You also have, the name itself, Thrutcher, comes from an old English word meaning to press down. And that is intended to, join the concepts of oppression and repression, which were both connotations that were built into that old English word, thrichan. And so it's it knocks opponents down, it tries to strangle them, But also, its body is frigidly cold. It's like the anti-salamander. You know how when you, the salamander has the heated body trait where you touch it, you take fire damage. The Thrutcher has frigid body. You touch it, you take cold damage. And that is symbolic of its inability to express emotion. That unemotionality combined with this force that can only crush and knock down and try to strangle, is how I chose to represent that.
I have a question for you there, Keith. Hey, when you're using these, when you're creating these metaphorical monsters, using metaphors as the input for monsters, is your goal here to apply what we were talking about earlier of applying those constraints to your imagination to create a more interesting monster by having those constraints in your head of like, well, it's a metaphor for X? Or are you expecting at the table to convey this enough to the players such that they can partake in the fantasy of destroying those metaphors?
So that's part of writing the adventure around the monster you've created. Sometimes you might have the entire story plotted out in your mind and just be creating the monster to slot into that, in which case you probably would take more of that approach that you just described. Other times, you know, when it's just sort of inspiration or a thought experiment, like in this instance, the degree to which you're going to lampshade it in the adventure might vary. Maybe you want to be very obvious about it. Maybe it's not really relevant to the story at all and just remains your little secret. It depends on what you're trying to accomplish with the adventure. If you were trying to make some kind of commentary on the forces that breed these kinds of attitudes, you might, for example, set a story in a community that is economically depressed or menaced by an outside threat or both, and then say this combination of forces is causing these undead to appear. Things like that. That's one way you can do it. And then, you know, clever players can say, oh, I see what you're doing. Now, you don't want to be so heavy-handed about it that it's all the players can talk about. You know, especially if it turns into a joke at the table, then you've misplayed your hand. But if you just have that like one knowing, like, oh, I see what you did, and then they dive right back and they're immersed in it again, you have hit a home run.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you could get like either extreme of player reaction to this, right? On the one hand, you may get the players who are just so excited to finally destroy the personification of what they despise. I'm like immediately thinking of how the story of how Mandy Patinkin it was always envisioning the six-fingered man as being a placeholder for cancer, right?
Yes. So, his, not just cancer, but his father's cancer. Yes.
Right, which is just delightful, right? But on the other hand, I could also easily imagine a group of players saying, well, how dare you, sir? How dare you try to enlighten me and impose your moral values as lessons into the content of this supposedly lighthearted beer and pretzels game we're playing.
Well, that's table dynamics. That's a different book.
Is that book on the list?
Is that not for me to write?
So one of the things about this book that I was just surprised, super pleasantly surprised, is you have probably about half a dozen really interesting in-depth interviews with other people who are experts in particular components around the issues of monsters. And among them, you have it's almost a 20-page interview with Mr. James Mendez Hodes, who we've had on the show here in the past, and we're delighted to have him. And I will say that when we had him on, perhaps for non-regular viewers of this channel, it was our most contentious episode ever. We had a bunch of comments after the fact in both directions about Mr. Hode's views on cultural sensitivity, and he's commonly works as a cultural sensitive reader. for a number of, you know, products that our friends have put out recently. And I thought it was really interesting here. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you, Keith, and James both have really strongly held beliefs around some of these issues. They're not 100% the same. And I thought it was really fascinating that you very politely challenged him on a couple of points to think about these kind of prickly issues, include, and then I'm thinking about this right now, because among the issues he came up with is like a lot of this is table dynamics. There's a lot of these issues that he would be happy to play with people that he's very familiar with. And then some of these issues he would not want to see with strangers. I thought that was a fascinating interview.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about James Mendez-Hodes, he and I have arrived at some similar positions by different paths. You know, he is a millennial person of color, cultural sensitivity consultant. He works in this field. He is also a student of religion. And a student of some of the writers, the fantasy writers, whose fantasy was informed by their religion, like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And I am a Gen Xer, former journalist, current beardy white guy. Maybe not as grognardy as some grognards out there, but I have my bits. You know, I came up playing AD&D. And yet, back in the early 90s, I was already playing D&D with some people who were exploring questions like, what if orcs are not really evil? What if people think orcs are evil because they are simply so ugly to them, and they are leaping to conclusions about this, and they actually have just as rich and deep a culture as everyone else? It's just people are not willing to see that. And that has always been ever since then, that's been a through line in my games. That's how I have run orcs. So when I saw his essay on, I think it was titled Orcs, Britons, and the Martial Race Myth, that made him somebody I wanted to talk to. And, you know, with the books that I'm writing now, I'm continually looking for ways to bring in something that I can bring to the table that other people are not going to. And in this case, what I tried to bring to the table was my background as a journalist. I have some interviewing chops, and I thought, you know, instead of just putting myself out here as the expert on these things, what I'd like to do is share my own perspectives, the fruit born of the thinking that I've done about all these things, but also bring in perspectives of other people who have a lot of experience thinking about these things and their own perspectives from which they're looking at them. And so I kind of ranged around from Mendez to Kelsey Dion, who created Shadowdark and had a very particular vision of what she wanted monsters to be in that game, to Chris Sims, who designed monsters for 4E and 5E and Pathfinder and Starfinder, aliens/monsters for Starfinder, to Mike McHarg, who does creature design for mass media, to Banana Chan, who does a lot of indie horror games that explore the symbolism of different monsters in some very interesting ways.
You've got Mike Mason, who's the current head of Call of Cthulhu, if I understand it. I thought that was
Mike Mason talking about the differences between cosmic horror and other kinds of tabletop fantasy. Yeah, and so I wanted to get some of those other perspectives out there, and I thought I could leverage my interviewing skills to put some interesting conversations in front of my readers.
I thought those were great. I thought really those interview sections are among the parts that were, again, really unexpected for me and really make this like a really standout, much deeper book than I think it would have been, than I expected going into it, frankly. Bad on me.
Thank you.
Yeah. For example, I thought the Mason interview was an interesting counterpoint to Hode's, actually, because they're coming from slightly different places. And on a couple of points there, they, like near the end, they said kind of in some cases exactly opposite things. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was really interesting multitudes that you've got in this particular book to chew on around these issues, what I thought was really, really valuable.
Yeah. And, you know, I see these perspectives as not being the end of a conversation, but being the beginning. If you, as a reader of this book, sit down and see Mendez saying one thing and Mason saying a different thing, then you start thinking, well, do I agree with Mendez more or do I agree with Mason more? Maybe I agree with Mason more, but Mendez makes a couple of good points that I don't want to let go of, or vice versa. And so then when you go out and design your monsters, you are taking the perspective that you have arrived at with those new inputs and making something that's all your own.
Let me ask this. So I just happen to be, I've been running a classic Star Frontiers campaign for about 2 years now, and we're getting towards the end of it. It's on this planet Volturnus. Was 1983 when Star Frontiers first came out, Doug Niles and some other people like that. And it's got a bunch of really bizarre, novel alien species on the planet that the player characters wind up crashing down on and then having to interact with. And my players are all, they're late 20s, early 30s now. And going into it, when I said we're playing this traditional campaign from the 80s, they really expected the aliens to be cringy and problematic. And I don't feel like I've done a lot of editing work. I feel like just I've done like maybe 1% of maybe shaving stuff here and there. And my players have been like really unexpectedly delighted by how much they've fallen in love with the alien Cthuloid octopus desert creatures and the weird trickster forest monkeys and the giant triple-eyed crab creatures of the hills. And they basically,
I mean, if you've watched any media, you know that aliens are for falling in love with.
Well, I guess so. I guess that's what's happening. They kind that's of like adore all of them in different ways, right? How much, so, you know, the taking a D&D perspective, you know, the main through line of making enemies here is certainly things that are obstacles, things that need to be defeated in some one, what fears that need to be overcome. How much of this, or do we need another book for making allies, making novel species allies that the players may or may contend with or may possibly be allied with? How much of this can we use for that?
I would say a lot of it, but you definitely need to approach it from a different perspective. Instead of seeing the creation, the monster, the creature, whatever, the adversary, as a fear to be overcome, or someone whose goals are at odds with those of the player characters, you need to come at it from the point of view of, here's someone who shares goals with the player characters. And you can complement that in interesting ways by saying, oh, but they don't agree on everything. There are some areas in which they are still at odds with each other, but the important thing is that they are allies on whatever issue or whatever situation or whatever threat is front and center at the moment. I also think that their power level becomes a lot less significant, because you don't want allies to overshadow the PCs. I don't know whether either of you gentlemen has played Tomb of Annihilation, but Tomb of Annihilation was a 5e adventure that was outstanding in many ways, but I think some damage was done to it by the fact that the PCs can very easily pick up multiple NPC allies who are more powerful than they are. Wow. And as a result, who end up pulling more of the weight, taking the spotlight off the PCs. If you are doing a traditional style experience point awards rather than story-based experience point awards, they are soaking off a share of the XP that the PCs are going to need further down the line. They're not leveling as fast, so they're becoming even more dependent on those more powerful NPCs. So that is something you want to be very cautious about. But you can certainly have metaphorical allies as well as metaphorical enemies. You can certainly have allies capable of cool 1-2 punch stunts as the monsters have. You can certainly think about, do they have magical abilities? And if so, in what ways do those abilities manifest? You can mine this book for that kind of stuff too. It's not what it's primarily designed for, and you do need to keep those few issues in mind that I don't deal with in the book that relate to allies. But yeah, I mean, one of the implicit messages of the book is that there is no wrong place to draw information from, or draw inspiration from. I drew inspiration from a weird storefront, from a restaurant menu typo, from a manual on marine small unit tactics, from that rash of stories in the news about orcas attacking yachts, there's no source of inspiration that I looked at and said, this is not good enough to create something from. You know, whatever. Anything can be made. Well, not anything. Almost anything can be made fun. You know, you just don't tell yourself, I have no ideas. Be willing to take, I mean, when I said a typo on a restaurant menu, I saw an option for ordering eggs on an online ordering system. And it said, how do you want your eggs? Over easy, fried, scrambled. And I started thinking, scamble. That's an interesting name for a creature. What would a scamble look like? What would it be able to do? And I created, and I ended up creating what I think is one of the most fun monsters in the book. One that could certainly be trotted out as an enemy for first level players. PCs just starting out, first level PCs. Just starting out, you know, something a little more fun than rats in the cellar. Okay? So, boring, right? We're all tired of rats in the cellar. So what if instead they go to the marketplace and you see these 8-armed gibbon things stealing stuff from people and playing keep away with it? I mean, you know? And when you try to come at them, they launch themselves off the side of a building and knock you down like a pro wrestler. I mean, how can you not have fun with that?
That's great.
You know? And that's from a typo on a restaurant menu.
And I feel like you're digging here at, like, for me at least, one of the key reasons to be constantly looking to make custom monsters, right? For a game that I believe ostensibly is about exploring a world, as you get accustomed to tropes that have been around for years or decades at this point, it stops feeling like exploration because you recognize, rats in the cellar, and now we're going to fight orcs, and now we're going to go fight a troll, and trolls are susceptible to fire, and etc. And it just
over familiarity is the enemy of memorability.
Yeah.
So how do you bring the memorability back? Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I adore that. I adore, you know, having custom stuff to throw at players. So they're just like, well, that's not in any book I've ever read. I guess I got to figure out what the heck it is. That's the life.
Yeah. And at the root of this book, at the root of this book is envy, because I have a friend, a good friend, good close friend of decades, who is just one of the most unbelievably creative people in the world, just comes up with stuff out of his head, like Athena from the Brow of Zeus. And I'm like, how do I keep up with you? You know, how do I compete with this?
That's amazing.
So he's got the creator's creativity, the inventive creativity, the spontaneous creativity. What if you don't have that? What if you want to create your own material, and like me, you just don't have that kind of creativity? Well, the remixer kind of creativity is equally valid. You know, if you don't have the kind of mind that can create something out of nothing, but you do have the mind that can create something out of something else, that's good too. There is nothing wrong with that. There is nothing second rate about that.
I have banked years of and decades of GMing on that very concept. I always say to myself that I feel like my world building is like quilting, right? I take a piece from here and I take a piece from there. I build something greater out of the whole, but it's still ultimately of pieces of other people's creation.
And that's okay as long as the pieces look good together.
Exactly. Keith, we are just about out of time here. Is there anything about the book that you wanted to get out to our viewers before we have to say goodbye?
Very, very proud of the illustrations in it, which were all done by my spouse, Jen C. Marshall. Some of her greatest work is in there. Actually, in fact, on I think one of my favorite illustrations is of what is not coincidentally one of my favorite monsters, the Calabasso, which was inspired by my daughter, who is a big fan of Halloween and likes to imagine, you know, riding all the giant inflatable spiders, and who told me I should make a monster that was part pumpkin, part spider, and part ghost. And And that led me down a path of multilingual free association that culminated in the Calabasso. And Dan, if you want to hold up the picture of the Calabasso, the Calabasso is basically a giant jack-o'-lantern on spider legs that goes around at night and punishes people for being out walking alone. And it picks them up, lifts off the top of its own head, and stuffs people inside itself. It's a great kind of fairy tale monster, and yeah, Jen's illustration of that is my favorite in the entire book. But they're all bang up,
it'd be
a much drier index book without them.
I just discovered you have a wonderful index on top of everything else. Well done.
Very, very timely monster for now. Here we are, just 2 days out of Halloween. Excellent. Viewers, if you have comments on building your own monsters, on thoughts that are provoked by the writings of making enemies, please share them with us here in the comment section of the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. That may spin up new ideas for future discussions here on the show.
And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and Loops and GitHub. And we have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and cook up that like button.
You just named one I haven't even heard of yet.
Ahead of the curve. That's the Wandering DMs. Everybody knows that.
Viewers, if you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only format, perhaps on your commute or as you're mowing the lawn, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com, also through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server, where the conversation continues around the clock 24/7 on old school D&D, new D&D, Pathfinder, miniatures, horror games, science fiction, everything that we adore. And so do our patrons. We'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation with our live video after chat with our patrons. So if you have more ideas on making enemies or other monsters, we would love to hear that. Me and Paul will be there. Keith, thank you so much for this.
Thank you for having me back.
Enemies and being here today. Lovely. Hopefully we can get you again for your next book, because they're getting better. They're getting better, Keith. Everyone I adore.
Thank you. Well, I can tell you that the next one is going to be The Monsters Know What They're Doing, revised for 2025. And tentative current release date is July 2026. So keep your eyes open and your wallets open for that.
We will definitely look for that. Thanks for thinking about that, Keith. And viewers, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.